Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the politics behind the just-concluded U.S.-China summit in Palm Springs from Susan Shirk, the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs. We'll discuss Obama and Xi's constructive summit in the context of what the Chinese leader is dealing with at home and what the president has on his plate with revelations about spying on Americans that pale in comparison to the extent that the Chinese government monitors its citizens. Then we'll get an appraisal of the economic issues discussed between the world's two biggest economies and the agreement to curb greenhouse gases causing global warming. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business at Indiana University, joins us to discuss the slowdown in the Chinese economy and the new Chinese leader's efforts to break up monopolies and oligopolies in state-owned enterprises. We'll also discuss concerns over the theft of intellectual property from U.S. corporations and the cyber theft of U.S. patents. Then finally, with yet another school shooting involving the tragic intersection of mental illness and easy access to assault weapons, we'll speak with Catherine Newman, professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University and author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. We'll discuss how a shooter who had a history of mental illness wearing full body armor with a handgun and an assault rifle with 1,300 rounds of ammunition was able to go on a rampage in Santa Monica College that ended up killing four people. And joining us now is Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Hongwei Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And both of the leaders who met in Palm Springs and seem to have the purpose, I think, of the meeting in many ways was for them to establish a personal relationship. They've pledged to build a new model of relations. So what do you think that means?
Well, I think they're making it up as they go along. And it's a concept that was proposed by the Chinese side. And at this meeting, Xi Jinping articulated it, and it basically is how to prevent China as the rising power and the United States as the dominant power from coming into conflict, especially military conflict, with one another. You know, the history of these moments of transition when you have a rising power challenging an incumbent power often lead to war. They almost always lead to war. So the challenge that American and Chinese leaders face is how to prevent that from happening.
So why is it incumbent upon the Chinese to bring this up? Surely this is something that the United States should also be concerned with.
Well, yes, the U.S. is, but the Chinese side loves to create these new labels for the relationship. The words, the terms, are extremely important to them. Americans are more can-do, practical people. You know, we say, well, let's just get on with it. Let's talk together and figure out what to do. We're less concerned with the concept.
So they like a sort of a structure. Is that to do with that sort of the notion of the five-year plans and all of that stuff, and everything has to have a slogan? And
well, part of it is, you know, Marxist-type ideology where we have the three goods and the five bads and this kind of formulaic language. But historians and cultural scholars would tell you that it goes even further back in Chinese tradition.
So the fact that the president described his sessions with the new President Xi, saying how they were terrific, and they had strolled in the greenery amongst the desert there, Friday night they had a dinner of lobster tamales, porterhouse steak, and cherry pie. prepared by the celebrity chef Bobby Flay. And apparently there wasn't much that any U.S. leader could do in terms of cozying up to the previous wooden leader, Hu Jintao. But this new leader appears to be much more easygoing. Is that right?
Well, certainly his temperament appears to be more relaxed, more confident, and so he's not afraid of the informal interaction. He doesn't feel that he has to have his talking points and stick exactly to the talking points the way Hu Jintao did. So, and from what I hear, it really was Xi Jinping who was very keen to accept President Obama's invitation for this kind of informal summit. And it's unprecedented in the relations between the two countries. Even Mao and Nixon didn't have as much one-on-one time together. So, I mean, I wish it had been even longer. It's 8 hours of face-to-face discussion. And there were a small number of key advisors in the room for most of those discussions. But there was some opportunity to go off to take a walk in the desert with just interpreters there. So it's really important because diplomacy is a matter of personal interaction, personal rapport, personal communication. And I think this is a very good way of starting to create that kind of bond between the two leaders that can be very helpful later on when they're trying to solve problems or even address crises.
And again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Hongwei Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest book is Changing Media, Changing China. So, how much, though, are there two President Xis, the one that talks to the cadres at home within the Communist Party, the ruling party that's under a certain amount of pressure from reformers and has certainly been exposed for the massive kleptocracy at the top, where billions of dollars are being sent abroad often with the children of the leadership. New York Times, of course, revealed the personal fortunes of some of the top leaders in the billions. So outwardly, he seems business friendly, but inwardly, some people have described him as being a Maoist.
Well, he certainly is trying to rule like a stronger individual leader, and he is using different themes and methods in order to give himself the authority to do some very difficult things, such as to try to control corruption at the top and to undertake a pretty ambitious economic reform. Probably the most important thing going on in China right now is that there are a group of economists and economic officials preparing drafts of a new round of market-oriented reforms that are going to be introduced in the fall. And that's very good news because the reforms stalled out over the past decade under Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, and instead the state control over the economy increased and big state-owned enterprises became more monopolistic, and the competitiveness of the Chinese economy was reduced. So, and that's related to corruption, too. So it's very, very important from the standpoint of U.S. interests, including business interests, and for the sustainability of Chinese growth that they carry out these economic reforms. So that's good news. Some of the other things that Xi Jinping has said did give us some cause for concern on the ideological front. It looks like they're cracking down in a way that we haven't seen for really since the Deng Xiaoping era. This is kind of a throwback to Maoism. We don't quite understand what that's all about, and it may be a kind of last gasp of the propaganda apparatus. It's hard to know. But this notion of a China dream that he's talked about that had a strong nationalist, anti-foreign flavor, it's interesting that at this meeting, he redefined what the China dream is and linked it to the American dream and to the dream of people in other countries, and said that it really is about cooperation with other countries, peace, and finding win-win solutions to problems. So, you know, I like to hear that language. I think that's really very constructive, and I'm sure that President Obama felt the same way.
Well, of course, President Xi, as a young man, spent time with a family in Iowa, but he does seem to have at least strong ties to the Chinese military. His wife, Peng Liyang, is a famous singer, and she's also a major general in the PLA. Didn't he serve as on the military committee as well?
Well, he was a staffer,
right,
for one of the senior-most generals as a young man. He didn't actually serve in the military himself. But you're right that he spent a lot of effort when he first came into office last fall to establish his authority over the military and to build credibility with them. And some of what he's been doing in these maritime territorial disputes may be related to that. But in this summit meeting, I think he made pretty clear by highlighting the importance of military-to-military dialogue with the United States, that he's in charge and he's telling the military, you know, I want you to get out and talk to the American military and stop this kind of worst-case scenario thinking and find ways that our two countries can cooperate on common problems instead of preparing for a military conflict with one another. And China is going to observe U.S.-led military exercises, RIMPAC exercises in Asia next year, which is, you know, a very important symbolic gesture and also a way that the two militaries might start to cooperate on common search and rescue activities or response to humanitarian disasters.
So the pivot that the Obama administration announced towards Asia, in many circles, was interpreted as a military redeployment away from our disastrous recent history in the Middle East towards Asia. So how much are we responsible for tit for tat in the military arena? Are we really making it clear that the pivot to Asia is not about military hegemony? It seems to be interpreted.
Well, yes, and I think the Obama administration feels misunderstood, because from the time that it came into office, the goal was to increase U.S. commitment and involvement in the region across the board. Diplomatically, Secretary Clinton's first trip was to Asia, joining in the regional organizations and being more active in them than we had previously. We appointed an ambassador to ASEAN who was actually posted out in the region trying to combat this tyranny of distance so that we would just be more present. And the military piece of this was actually fairly minor you know, very small numbers of Marines training in Australia and some new refueling and repair, repair facilities in Southeast Asia. So, but what, because of the fact that the Chinese side was behaving somewhat more provocatively in the region and alarmed its neighbors, somehow the whole effort of the pivot or rebalancing came to be viewed as a U.S. military balance against China. And that's really not what it was all about. And this summit is giving both sides the chance to make that clear, to recalibrate their policies, and to emphasize the potential for cooperation.
And hence the discussions about why the how not to have these the present hegemon clash with the rising hegemon.
Right. And, you know, I don't think, I think the United States is realistic about China's rising power, and we're happy to see that Japan's economy is recovering and India is an important country. Indonesia and South Korea are very large and significant countries. So, you know, I don't think U.S. preeminence or military hegemony in Asia is something that we feel needs to be sustained forever. I mean, I think that's unrealistic myself. What we are hoping is that our participation in the regional system, economically, politically, and militarily, can help the countries in the region cooperate better and prevent them from coming into conflict with one another.
Just in closing, Susan Shirk, as I mentioned in the opening, the president has been preoccupied, presumably, with these stories about NSA wiretapping, and there was a leak to the UK Guardian of a finding where the president list of countries that the president wanted to target for U.S. cyber attacks, and that would seem to have been embarrassing for the president on the very eve of when he's apparently going to be talking with the Chinese president about their cyber attacks on the United States. That would seem to undercut what he was saying. But I guess there's another way to look at it, and that is that maybe that this gave the president an opportunity to talk about how much China monitors its own citizens, and what the U.S. is doing in comparison seems to pale.
Well, I think it was poor timing. At a minimum, it was a big distraction. If you look at the press conferences and press briefings, you know, this is the issue du jour, and it's what the journalists wanted to ask questions about. And it does, of course, highlight America's own capabilities to monitor the internet and telephone communications. What the U.S. side was trying to do is to emphasize Chinese theft of commercial secrets and technology of private firms using cyber attacks to steal those kinds of secrets. It really wasn't to have a discussion about the way each of us conducts espionage on one another, because, of course, the Chinese are not the only ones doing that. So we are trying to highlight the fact that this severe effort, major effort, to go after pretty much every firm that's doing business in China to try to get information about what they're doing and take their commercial and technological secrets, that it's very bad news for U.S.-China relations, because it undercuts the support that the business community has provided in the past for U.S. engagement of China. I mean, they're feeling really fed up with China. And that's very bad news for the overall relationship. So, but you're right. that all the discussion about these other programs, which of course are focused on national security, were a distraction and made clear to the Chinese that what they already know this, of course, because they've hacked into many of these programs, that our capabilities are much greater than theirs.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Susan Shirk.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Susan Shirk, who is the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Hongwei Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Director of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened the Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the economic aspects of the China-U.S. summit.
Ooh. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.